Well, welcome to Keys of the Kingdom. I'm Brother Gregory, and we're going to talk about the Kingdom of God. Somebody watched one of our videos on the internet yesterday, or actually last night, and I think it was the video on Republic. And I was on another radio show yesterday, and some of these terms came up, like Republic. And actually on Facebook, there were some people that were talking about a republic, and I made a few comments, and somebody who's not normally on my Facebook page, who doesn't know who I am, made a comment back because of that overlapping nature of Facebook. And they said, well, clearly the more you say, the more I realize that you don't know what you're talking about, because I give you facts and you come back with your opinion. Well, I guess anybody who reads my books, you know that I don't just come back with my opinion. I come back with, you know, hundreds of footnotes as to where I get this crazy notion. And the problem in every one of these cases is the fact that people don't know the definition of the word republic. And one of the reasons why is because people have been trying to alter the definition of a republic for quite some time. Most of what people think of as a republic or a constitutional republic, which is kind of an oxymoron, a constitutional republic, or can be, is they think that an indirect democracy is the same as a republic. A republic is not a democracy. It is the antithesis of a democracy. In a republic, which originally comes from a Latin idiomatic phrase, liber res publica, which means free from things public, has to do with a form of government in which the rulers, or leaders, I should say leaders, that's incorrect for me to say rulers, although it could be applied in some situations, the leaders of a republic are titular. Now it goes all the way back to Bouvier's, and you know, for hundreds of years, that reference to the leaders being titular has been consistent for the definition of a republic. Well, titular means in name only. They have no personal authority themselves. They have an office and the name in that office, but they have no authority. It's kind of like the original Senate of Rome, which kind of meant the old men. And it had no legislative power, really, except over, you know, matters concerned in the Senate itself. You know, it couldn't regulate. It couldn't say, okay, we're all going to go to war. You know, you could all be drafted into the army, and now you all have to do things our way. No, they didn't have that power. They were just representatives of individual free people. And the Senate was, you know, they arrived at the Senate through a network of people. You know, so many people got together, hearths they used to call them, and they would elect somebody who would elect somebody with other men like themselves, and eventually they would end up with this Senate, who usually was consisted of old men. And they would get together and they would talk things, and then they would go back to their constituency and say what the consensus of opinion was. They had no power to rule over other people. They were simply bringing a representation to a single group so that they could talk things out and then take that representation, whatever that group came to a conclusion of, and bring it back to the people and see if they wanted to cooperate. That's a republic, free from things public, not subject to kings or old men. You were working together as a community for a common purpose, because the leaders were titular. They weren't rulers. Now, I said the word senator could be referred to as a ruler because they did have the power to rule over certain things, like when are we all going to meet? You know, the majority of them would say, well, we're going to meet tomorrow at 9 o'clock. And everybody agreed, or most everybody agreed. Nobody could stop that meeting simply because one guy says, well, I don't want to meet at 9. I only want to meet at 10. Well, he doesn't have to show up till 10, but they could make decisions like that. It's kind of like the executive orders of the president. The original first executive order of George Washington was, what kind of dishes are we going to get? Yeah, that was it. That was it. Originally, the executive office of the United States was to execute the decisions of the Senate and Congress. The Congress was the representatives of the people. And the Senate was the representatives of the states, sent by the states, elected by the states. Now, that changed by the 17th Amendment, but it wasn't the 17th Amendment alone that brought that change about. The 17th Amendment was actually an adjustment to a change that was already taking place. Is that the executive power of the government was now expanded because now there was more to make executive powers over, which was the citizens of the United States, who were no longer citizens of their local state, but citizens of the United States. You know, and actually, to get a gun now in the state of Oregon, somebody was just talking to me about filling out the, you know, somebody I know just bought another gun, saw a good deal on a .22 rifle, and he said, you know, I paid almost that much 10 years ago. And so he bought another one. And so he had to do the background check now. And so he went down the questions. And one of the questions was, have you ever denounced your citizenship to the United States? And they also had another question there that was really kind of unique. Have you ever denounced your citizenship to the state of Oregon? And it was very interesting that they put it there, because normally you're not classified as a citizen of the state of Oregon. You're classified as a resident of the state of Oregon and a citizen of the United States. Well, if you know, I pointed out that distinction once before in a group of ministers who had invited me, and one of them said, well, you know, that's not what resident means, is that, you know, I'm a resident of Oregon, but I'm also a citizen of Oregon. And I says, well, actually, a resident means that you're a foreigner residing in another location. And see, if you're a citizen of the United States, you're a foreigner to Oregon. So they use these terms kind of in an odd sort of way and misapplied. It's the same term, but if you said citizen of the state of Oregon back in 1858 or 18 say 60 or a citizen of Texas would be even a better example, it meant something quite a bit different. You weren't a resident of Texas, you were a citizen of Texas. If you went to Washington DC and lived there, you would be a resident of Washington DC but not a citizen. But then along comes, you know, the 14th Amendment, and now you can be a citizen of the United States and a resident of your local state. Anyway, that may be a little bit too complicated. The point is that this idea of a republic, because Texas used to be a republic, and then it became a state of the United States, and it still refers to itself as the sovereign state of Texas, although it's not sovereign anymore because of everything from revenue sharing to the 17th Amendment. And, you know, Judge Andrew Napolitano actually considers the 17th Amendment to be unconstitutional. Well, it would only be unconstitutional if it was ratified in an unconstitutional manner, which is possible, but I don't know that that's what he means. And even if it was ratified in an unconstitutional manner, it has since been acquiesced to. I mean, because the Constitution itself was illegally ratified, because all the states had made an agreement they would make no changes to the Articles of Confederation without unanimous agreement. That was their contract. That was their agreement. And, of course, they ratified the Constitution of the United States without unanimous agreement, and even use coercion to force states like Rhode Island to cooperate and to also ratify it. And so that would make it an illegal ratification. But since then it's been acquiesced to. And so therefore we could say the same thing about the 17th Amendment. And this is where people have difficulty in understanding what a republic is because of the fact that they don't understand the mechanism of how governments gain power. And so originally in the Liber Respublica of the Roman Republic, the Senate had no power, virtually no power, power over insignificant things that had to do with, did not have to do with the lives of the individuals of the Roman Republic. Because you see, that's another thing about a republic, is that it is the state, small s, state, independent of its form of government, or independent of its government. Well, what state? Whenever you're talking about the state, you're talking about the state of an individual. And since they're not capitalizing, they're not talking about the state of a corporation of people, but an individual people. And when the people are independent, then they're free from things public. And you have a pure republic. And the leaders of that republic are titular, in other words, in name only, and the people don't have to follow what they decide or what they agree upon. But they are there to create the possibility of agreement and compliance and cooperation. That's what a republic is. It's not an indirect democracy where you elect lawmakers and they go and make rules for you that you have to obey, whether you like to or not. That's not a republic. That's an indirect democracy. We call that a republic today, but then again, Rome called itself a republic even after the Roman emperors were making rules like it was a crime to be, suspicion became a crime even. To question the authority of the emperor became a crime. Yeah, well, that's not a republic. That's an imperial. And if the emperor is elected by a democracy or indirect democracy, it's a democratic imperialism. It's like what you have today. Federal government is a semi-democratic because of the fact you do have elections. You have parties that run, put people into office. But those people that you elect, those senators, those congressmen, and the president, they're not titular. They have real power. They rule over you. Even the Supreme Court can tell you what is good and what is evil. They can say, abortion is good. You have to pay for your neighbor's abortion. They can make you do that. They can say, there's weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, so now you have to buy bombs so we can bomb 1 million people. And you have to do it. You have to pay them. Because you're in an indirect democracy where the leaders have a great deal of power. And that power has been growing now to the point of exponential power has been growing. And whose fault is this? Well, of course, they're to blame for any decisions they make, but you're to blame for giving them the power. How did you give them the power? I mean, if you were one time a true republic, free from things public, not even a party to the Constitution. That's one of the amazing things people talk about the Constitution. We the people had to do with them. It's very clear, even the Supreme Court has agreed that the people were not a party to the Constitution. So if you're not a party to it, then we the people can't mean you. It must mean somebody else. And of course it did. It meant the names that you see at the bottom of the document. They didn't have any power to sign for Joe Schmo, in Poughkeepsie. They were just supposed to explore forms of government. Things that they could change in the Articles of Confederation. But they came up with this whole new document. So when they signed it, they were just signing, saying, this is what we've come up with. They didn't make any law. but we, the people who signed it, were the names at the bottom. And then anybody else who signed on to it, every congressman, every senator who agreed, everybody who took an oath to keep it, the terms of that Constitution, were now we, the people. Now, the problem today is we got oath keepers going out there saying, we're going to keep our oath to the Constitution. And then they begin to interpret it. Except for the Constitution tells you the one who gets to interpret it is the Supreme Court. It's not you. You don't get to interpret it. By its nature, you don't get to interpret it. You wield around this oath keeper that I'm in charge kind of thing because you think you're a free person already. But you're not. Because you don't understand operations of law, how law works, how governments get power, how one's liberties, rights to choose, are diminished. Do you understand how they can be diminished? You say, well, they're inalienable rights. Yeah, but you can say, if you give me $100, I will work for you tomorrow all day long till the sun sets. You can make that agreement, and you can sign it, and he can give you $100, and you can go bet it on the horses. But when tomorrow comes, you got to work for him all day long until the sun sets. That's the deal. You took the $100. You sold what you're going to do. You have all your inalienable rights, but you have now an inalienable obligation that you've created because you took something from him, $100, and bet it on the horses, lost, and now you owe him. You don't have another $100 to give him back, so now you got to work for him all day long because you made an agreement. You still have your inalienable rights, but you have an obligation through contract, through agreement, through acceptance and performance. That's the way it works. And every one of you have taken the $100, taken the bait. Free education, free health care, take care of my parents because I want to do no more ought for my parents. So I've signed up for this Social Security system, and my parents have signed up and cursed me with their debt. And then when they were sick, I didn't take care of them. I had the government, sending a check every month to take care of them. Yeah, a bankrupt government with a bankrupt Social Security system was going to take care of my parents every month. And you went farther and farther into debt. And now the sun rises and you have to work all day long for the payment of that obligation. But back to a republic again. A republic, the leaders are titular. They don't have any power. Do you know, if you were to list all the forms of government that you could possibly have in one column, and then you were to put the word republic over in the other column, and you were to draw a line from the word republic to the other column, to the government that was most like a republic, where would that line go to? Would it go to a communist? I mean, because we got Union of Soviet Socialist Republic and the Chinese Republic, which are all communist regimes, but call themselves republics. So could you draw a line over to communist? Because that's a lot like a republic. No. If you put all the different kinds of governments, socialism and anarchy and communist governments and all these different kinds of governments over here on the right-hand side. When you drew that line, there's only one government I can think of that you could possibly draw a line to. And it's anarchy. That's right, because a pure republic is an anarchy. What is an anarchy? What is he talking about? Anarchy, that's chaos, right? No, anarchy is without archy, the Greek word for ruler. in a republic, there are no rulers over the people. There are only leaders who are titular in name only. So there are no rulers in a republic who can exercise authority over you. Now, you may give them certain jobs, like you can say to the United States federal government, you protect us from foreign invasion. You go out there and you patrol the borders to make sure that nobody invades this country. And that's one of the jobs that it has. And it has authority over protecting the borders. All you should have to prove is that you're an American. And you can do that with two witnesses. You know, lots of different forms. Now, they can suddenly say, no, you can only prove that you're an American if you have one of our birth certificates. And you can only prove that you're American if you have one of our passports. But you can only get one of our passports if you sign up for our Corbin, our Social Security system, and waive your rights. Then you can have our passports. If they say that, then they're not protecting Americans. They're coercing you into becoming one of them. And they could actually do that. You know, and rightfully so, they could do that because they're looking at a passport as that when you go out into the world, we will protect you because this passport, we're guaranteeing your safety. Protection draws subjection, so now they can subject you. But what if they were, just to give you what the French call a laissez-passe, you know, let them pass. And that means you don't get any protection when you go abroad. When you come back, they will let you pass. Now, I'd be curious as to if the United States government had some deal like that, where you could actually get a form of passport that would let you come and go, but offered you no protection. Because any free American who actually existed, they could get that. But if you go and get a passport, they tell you in the statutes that you're subject to them. They tell you that anyone who gets, no one can have a passport of the United States without swearing an oath of allegiance to the United States. So anyway, back to republic again. So you're beginning to see that a republic is not an indirect democracy where 51% of the people can elect somebody who can take away your rights. No. A republic, a pure republic, a real republic, not what is posing as a republic today, the leaders are titular. They just simply don't have exercising authority one over the other. They cannot rule over you and your life. But we've left that a long time ago, and we've returned to the mire. We've bogged down in systems that are very archy, very exercising of authority against the will of Christ. We'll talk about that when we come back. Welcome back to Keys of the Kingdom. And we were looking at this word republic. In a republic, the leaders are only titular. They gather together. So do we have any examples of such a republic in throughout history? And of course, early Rome, like I said, Roman history lasted over 900 years, almost 1,000 years. And I mean, it depends on, you know, if you're talking about the history of the people themselves or this idea that they became a republic. They didn't, the republic didn't last 400 years, 500 years tops. Certainly it was gone by the time Augustus Caesar at the end of the Civil War that took place. You know, the republic was dead. I mean, some of the attempts to restore the republic involved, rebellion and the killing of Caligula, but the Praetorian Guard had gained so much power that they just simply grabbed a hold of Claudius and held him up and said, "The emperor's dead, behold the new emperor." You know, and when they started these killings where they were trying to overthrow this empire, they would actually kill everybody who was a member of the family, because they didn't want anybody to come back, you know, and take the reins of power and control again. And of course, there are assassinations that have taken place in our own history to prevent certain people who do exercise a certain amount of influence into gaining power and to informing people as to what's really going on. So they have so much assistance. You know, I mean, the guy who was talking about as if he knew what a republic was on Facebook had started making comments on a video, which was the speech given by JFK, where he talks about through covert means that there's, you know, the secrecy that, and everything. Parts of that speech we often hear on the radio program here, and it's a very good speech, and you should read it or hear it. It's available. I think he gave the speech originally at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel, and it was a speech really trying to encourage the press to back him up in trying to re-educate the people as to what has actually gone on in America and this loss of freedom, individual freedom in America. There's a huge collective freedom that is now the case, you know, freedom from work. You don't have to work. That's what the collectivism is promising you, peace and freedom. You don't have to work. You don't have to be responsible for yourselves. You don't have to take care of your parents. You don't have to pay for your education. You don't have to pay for your health care. You don't have to do anything. Freedom, freedom, freedom. They offer you freedom, but it's in the collective. And what that really means is that somebody's going to have to pay the light bill. Somebody's going to have to pay the cost and the expense. I mean, they've recently had SWAT teams raiding people who failed to pay their student loans. So all you guys who think, student loans really cool because I get my education and I can put it off. I know people are actually putting off getting a good job because then once they get a good job, they're going to have to start paying back their student loans. And they think somehow that's a good thing. But there are people who have actually had SWAT teams come in and throw them to the ground and handcuff them because of failure to pay student loans. So if you think putting off your student loan payments a good idea, you might want to think that over a little bit better. Of course, thinking isn't really been your forte since you went out and took a student loan to begin with, which is an insane thing. The mere idea of student loans is probably the single most effective way to raise the cost of education, because with all these loans coming in, all these foolish people who will take them, where's the motivation in universities to lower the tuition, to tighten their belts, to take a look at their budget and see if they can produce good education that everybody would want for less money? That motivation's gone because of student loans. You see, whatever you decide to do and the way in which you decide to do it, the means by which you decide to do something, alters the outcome. And that's what you have to start to see. You have to step back and get a bigger picture of what actually is going on in the world today and in your life today. Because the die is cast, the path is set, you're careening down the mountainside, and gravity is taking over. And it's going to be a bumpy ride. You know, I saw a quote from Ben Carson yesterday or last night. And it was, if I get it right, "We've been conditioned to think that only politicians can solve our problem. But at some point, maybe, we will wake up, he says, and recognize that it was politicians who created the problems to begin with. And it's not unlike what Ronald Reagan said, that you can't solve the problem with government. Government is the problem. But there's a certain truth in what he says from a certain perspective. And that's the thing, is you have to learn how to look at problems from different angles, from different perspectives. But the truth is, you're the problem, not the politician. It's the fact that your perspective of looking to the politician to solve the problem is the problem, not the politician. Your perspective is the problem, because you're looking to him to solve the problem. Way back during the American Revolution, it says, as long as you look to government to solve your problems, you will always suffer tyranny. There, that's even more to the point. Because they're telling you, it's your perspective of looking to the government to solve the problem that creates the problem to begin with for you. You can change your perspective. You're not going to change the politician. He's you know, you're not going to make a skunk smell sweet with perfume. The skunk odor is still going to be pervasive. You just can't cover it up. By the time you've got enough perfume to cover it up, the perfume has become a noxious gas. But you can change your perspective. And in other words, the way you see things. Now, all of our shows on, like, the Rees Commission and everything has been attempts by wealthy philanthropic organizations to change the way in which Americans view history, their perspective, the way they see things. How do we turn that back? How do we look back the other way? Another way, a better way, a more righteous way. That's what Christ was doing. You know, there's a number of movements. G. Edward Griffin and some other guys. I was trying to think of what their name is. It's like Utopia or something. But they have annual meetings and everything. And they're trying to go back, kind of a libertarian movement, trying to go back to a freer government. And they have a whole list of people that they call upon to, spread their philosophy and their ideas. And, we're not on that list. I always thought that was interesting that we don't seem to get on that list. But one of the reasons why is because we insist upon using this name, His Holy Church. And, people have been trying to get us on Alex Jones. He's one of the people that are on that list. Mike Adams is another guy on that list. Sheriff Mack. I know Sheriff Mack. I've met Sheriff Mack. We had long talks. Make a note of how many times Sheriff Mack would whisper during our conversation. We were in agreement all the time, but there were certain things that, oh, man, he didn't want to go. What he used to say is that, don't want to die on that hill. Bob Schultz, I've met Bob Schultz. And all these guys, great guys, got lots of different ideas. Phil Hart, Catherine Austin Fitz, I've met her. Interesting lady. Lots of these people are a part of their, D.V. Kidd. I'm just running through the names in my head. Sharon Tenpenny. And we have lots in common with them. But somehow or other, we don't seem to break into that barrier. But that's up to you. You guys have to break us into that barrier. You guys, if you hear in our message, the revelations, when I was just on the Ocelli's show just yesterday, the guy just said, we've never had anybody like this guy, referring to me. That he was trying to stump me, trying to get under my skin in private conversations, you know, trying to figure out, you know, trying to testing me, which is fine. You know, I prefer that. But he was shocked that we could go almost anywhere. Now, he actually took the conversation yesterday in a direction that normally I don't do in public. We do it in private, in discipleship and individually, because it can easily sound a little bit new agey, and people are so easily, you know, twisted and turned by pushing certain buttons, certain vocabulary, use certain kinds of words or phrases, and suddenly people are off on a tangent, thinking, oh, that's new age or something. Well, the reality is the, you know, the Bible, the New Testament, is full of stuff that looks, actually, if you look at it, it's very new agey. I mean, Peter's seeing angels and healing the sick with his touch and, you know, it, with a shadow, just passing in a shadow, somebody could get healed. And what's really going on? What's the mechanism? Well, we got a little bit into the mechanism of that, just touched on it, of how that works. Because there's actually a mechanism in the spiritual realms. You know, it's not just hocus pocus. You know, God has created a very well-ordered universe. And Christ came to teach us the truth in spirit and in truth. The kingdom of God in spirit and in truth. And spirit doesn't mean simply etherical or in your thoughts or in your imagination. It actually has a physical reality to it. And so, yeah, healing should be real to everybody. You know, and I was pointing out, and this is just, you know, in scientific journals, it's not something I made up, is that children sometimes born with genetic disease. They have the genetic disease. They're born with it. And so therefore you should see the symptoms popping up in that individual. And they end up with a wet nurse, you know, somebody to breastfeed them that is not of their family. Doesn't have that genetic problem. They're just a wet nurse because the mother had a genetic disease and couldn't nurse the kid, and they thought it was important to nurse the kid, and so they were able to hire somebody who was lactating and would nurse their child. It used to be very common. Used to, of course, nursing a child was the only way to raise a child, and so it was a lot more common. Nowadays, people stick a bottle of, you know, some sort of chemical milk in their mouth and say, well, that's like just like nursing. But anyway, what they discovered was that this wet nurse, not having the genetic disposition, had an effect on the baby. And the genetic disease that was evident disappeared. Well, that's impossible. Well, no, it's not impossible. It actually happened. And it happens more than often than you would think. Doesn't happen all the time, but the reality, what is happening there? There's actually genetic material in nursing a child that goes into the body, and that genetic material goes into the cell, and that genetic material, it becomes a part of the epigenetic makeup of the cell and will turn on genes, which is the problem with most genetic diseases, is that something's not turned on. Or something is turned on or turned up too much, is overreacting. And so by bringing this extra genetic material into the diet of the child through nursing, the child was cured. There have been children with autism that were actually, because their parents had, their mother had problems, the child was actually being raised in a mental institution. Because the child stayed with the mother. The presence in the mental institution cured the autism. Did you know autism can be cured? Schizophrenia can be cured? Not in the way that most people want to do it, but it can actually be cured, be overcome. There may be residual effects of it for a long time, but I believe that even those residual effects can be cured. But you have to start looking at the reality that you're in with a broader view, where you take in not just the physical evidence that you see there, which is like looking, trying to study genetics without studying epigenetics. You know, you're just going to get the DNA strand, the double helix, and put the whole code together. But when they do that, they see that, you know, 45 to 50% of the code isn't even turned on. It's having no effect. They can't figure out what's that doing. Well, that's because most of your genetic code is turned off. But your epigenetic material, that other material that's in each individual cell, can actually have an effect on turning those genes on. Well, that's just in the genetic realm of your makeup. Let's take a look at some of the other realms, your nervous system, your muscular system. How about your spiritual system? You know, we look at the physical body and we say there's muscles and there's bones and there's all this structure, you know, and we see the nervous system and the digestive system and all these different systems because we can draw pictures of them and, you know, put them up on a board and you say, well, that's the complexity of a man. But when we make reference to the spiritual side of a man, it's just the spiritual side. You know, it's this kind of vague, ghostly spiritual side. But it's just as complex. Your spiritual mechanism is just as complex, maybe even a little more so, than your physical being. And it has all kinds of little things to it that you, most of you, are completely unaware of. You're just the same as you're unaware of what's going on in your epigenetic DNA, or your DNA. You don't even know what all that is. I mean, the biggest vision you have of yourself is you get in the bathroom mirror. You need to understand all of that. So what's keeping you from understanding all of that? Well, there's actually lots of things that are keeping you from understanding all of that. And that's what Christ came to help you see. To help you see how this works. And had a remarkable change on a small portion, 3 or 5% of the Roman population. You know, only about 5% at maximum ever became Christian. And then you have to realize that some of the people that became Christian were not really all that Christian. But amongst them were maybe 3%, 1.5%, 2%. Depending on where you want to draw the line, that were really Christian. And these people were able to foresee things that were coming and stand up and say, hey, you know, there's going to be a depression. There's going to be an invasion. There's going to be this disaster or that disaster. They were able to say, well, here's the solution. This is where we got to go. Here's what we do. And they were actually able to lay hands on people. And those people would be healed if those people were receptive to the same spirit. And this is some of the things that we talked about on this other show, is that, you know, like the woman who touched the hem of Jesus' garment wasn't just any woman. She was a woman ready to receive the Spirit of Christ. His character. She was receptive to it. That means she had to accept the idea of forgiving. She had to accept the idea of giving. She had to accept the idea of sacrifice. Yourself for others. To lay down your life for others. She had to accept that. I mean, not just in her head, but all the way down into her being, into her spirit. Because she was willing to accept that, she also received healing. Simply by touching the hem of his garment. He actually felt energy going out of him. So, you hear me talking about these things. You hear me also explaining the mechanism of your bondage today in the world. And of the world. What are you doing about it? Are you willing to receive you're understanding your personal responsibility for the condition of the world today. If you are you willing to sacrifice today for your fellow man, like Christ came to sacrifice himself that ye might be saved? Who are you going to sacrifice yourself for that they might be saved? Your children, your grandchildren, your neighbor? Because you got to care about your neighbor just as much as you care about your own children. If you don't, Christ is not in you. Not the way he needs to be in you for you to be healed. So anyway, we started out the show and I explained the simple thing that a republic, a pure republic, the original idea of a republic, libera res publica, free from things public, had leaders that are titular only, don't exercise authority. A pure republic is a collective of individuals where the power of governing is separate from the administration of government, the people who actually, you know, perform the services of government. Those people who perform the services of government, they cannot compel your offerings. Those offerings, those taxes, can only be compelled upon you by you. You have to choose to give. And the reason you choose to give, you need to choose to give, is because if you don't lay down your life, you will not have life more abundant. Christ came to give, not to take. He was a king who came to give you the power to rule yourselves, not to rule over you. It's a different spirit than what you see in governments of the world today, because they're not of Christ. They're of another spirit. And we're going to talk about this other spirit eventually here in this series. But you have gone away from the ways of Christ and returned to the mire. You have become entangled again in the elements of the world. Because you look to the world to solve your problems, to provide for you, to take care of you, to protect you. Even though you knew the world would only do this at the expense of your neighbor, you accepted that that was okay and you turned a blind eye to the fact that the rulers that you are electing are only going to be able to help you by taking away from your neighbor. Fundamentally, from day one, you have been going the wrong way once you ratified your Constitution of the United States. Now, I'm not saying get rid of it. I think it should be there because the slothful should be under tribute. And, you know, I mean, the same reason why Samuel appointed Saul. He knew it was a bad idea, but the people wanted it. And God knew it was a bad idea, but the people wanted it. And so God said, give him what they want. That's what they choose to have. Let them have that. I say the same thing, but I will say the same speech that Samuel said. They will take and take and take and take and take and take until you finally cry out. And that, of course, is where you're at today. After 200 years of taking, the taking has become unbelievable. What's the solution? Well, that's what we're going to talk about next on Keys of the Kingdom, so stay tuned. We're going to find the solution to the error of your ways. We'll be right back.
You have been listening to The Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory of His Holy Church. For more information on the educational ministry provided by His Holy Church and Brother Gregory, including services, counseling, lectures, books, and other audio materials, please write to His Church at Summer Lake, Box 10, Summer Lake, Oregon, 97640. You can also find us on the web at www.hisholychurch.net.